Welcome to the latest episode of Global Class, a podcast where we explore the international expansion stories of the world's fastest growing companies and the career journeys of their globally minded leaders. My name is Aaron McDaniel, and I'm here with my co-host, Klaus Wiehe.
Omar Sinham is the co-founder and host of the award-winning $100 MBA Show, a top business podcast with over 90 million downloads. He's also the co-founder and CEO of Webinar Ninja, named one of the fastest growing SaaS companies in 2018. Omar is a former educator and university manager turned entrepreneur, and today he applies his passion for teaching and learning to the business world. In today's conversation, we talk about Omar's strategies for entering new markets and reaching customers, tips for giving timely and culturally sensitive feedback, and examples of effective localized marketing campaigns, and why there's no such things as over-communication in a remote workplace.
Well, Omar, thanks so much for joining us from half a world away, right? You are in Australia now. Both Klaus and I are in the San Francisco Bay Area. I have a lot to talk about, you know, in terms of Webinar Ninja and your journey, but let's maybe rewind a little bit. You have an interesting background, coming by way of Dubai and coming from the US originally to where you are in Australia. But maybe give a little background on you, and we'd love to dig into it a little bit.
Sure. My parents immigrated to the States when I was wasn't born yet, so I was born in the US. They migrated from Egypt to the US. I think that's probably the best gift I ever got in my life, because growing up in that kind of environment, your parents expect you to do well and get good grades, and they sacrificed a lot. I got a real good definition of what hard work means, and it also gave me the sense of adventure. Like, the idea of taking a risk in life was not foreign to me, because I saw my parents do it, and I leaned on that a lot of the times. Both my parents worked. My mom was a dietitian, and my dad was an architect by trade. But during the late 70s, there was a bit of a financial crisis, lost his job, picked up a sales job just to kind of, make ends meet, fell in love with it. My dad is actually, a car salesman for 25 years. Which is like the typical thing that people think about when they can think of sales. And I kind of resisted business and sales, because I would see my dad do long hours. I would go to work with him, and I kind of just like, no, I'm gonna do something else. So I moved into teaching. That was my first career. I was an educator for 13 years. I taught at the high school university level as a teacher trainer and head of department at the university. And the funny thing is that when I started teaching, the internet was starting to pick up. It was like 2002. I was like, can you make money on this thing? What is this thing all about? I started doing some, I would call them experiments. I didn't even think of them as like hustles or businesses, just to see like what is this thing, And I started doing arbitrage on eBay. My first kind of business was I used to arbitrage rare Air Jordan sneakers. I used to find a buyer, find a seller, and
business now.
Yeah, I was before. This is even before the retros, before he was even trendy. But the funny thing is that some of the stuff that my dad was good at kind of seeped in somehow, in terms of the sales and the marketing and just the relationship building. And I started building businesses on the side when I was teaching. One of my first kind of global business experiences was when I was teaching. I was teaching in Dubai, actually, at the university there. And I had a side business where it kind of created out of just happenstance, really. I am 6'5". I am tall. I have long arms. So I was interested in just getting tailor-made shirts for myself in Dubai. It's not like an uncommon thing to go to the tailor shop and do that. And I used to go back to the States and visit my family back home and my friends, and they'd be like, hey, what are you wearing? This is a very interesting shirt. Or, that looks really nice and well-fitted. And I said, oh, it's just something I custom-made for myself over there. And they're like, oh, can you make me one? And, two friends became 20, and then 20 became 50. And I was like, okay, this is starting to get a little out of hand. So I started a small clothing line called Zenma Designs. And it just blew up over the last, 2 years when I started my first 2 years running it. We had warehouses across the world. We were shipping, internationally. And I learned a lot about customs. I learned about tax. I learned about different markets, different pricing, different needs. It was just a great experiment, and a great experience for me as a first kind of full-time business as I built that. One, building a team in Dubai, trying to figure out how best to motivate that team and find great talent, but also understanding the other markets I was serving and creating things that was suitable for those markets. So that's a little bit of my life. I started as a teacher and became a full-time entrepreneur about 12 years ago.
That's awesome. And well, and you continue to teach with your podcast, MBA and whatnot. So it's interesting. You highlight what you did as well. So in one of our frameworks in Global Class, we talk about the localization premium analysis, and the top part are go-to-market related. The bottom part are more operational. And we talk about how it's a bit of an iceberg. Like a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of executives think about the tip of the iceberg, the pricing, you know, the differences in marketing message. But as you were talking about customs and all these other things, there's so much under the surface that you don't think about as it relates to government relations or government compliance otherwise. So really interesting. So, you know, one thing that I think is really interesting, especially with the perspective you have having lived in different continents and run businesses from them, has a lot to do with culture, right? And you were starting to touch on it a little bit in terms of differences of culture, maybe in teaching in a place like Dubai versus teaching in the United States where you were educated, right? So, you know, talk a little bit about what that experience was like. You know, how did you adapt even your teaching style, if you think about it? Because as a teacher, your product is you know, the lessons you give. How did that change?
A lot of people don't realize because they look at Dubai on TV and in magazines with the, you know, skyscrapers. It's a Bond movie, really. It looks incredibly, you know, snazzy. But the country is only like 48 years old, like literally 48 years ago, there were Bedouins in the desert. You know, there's actually a very famous picture of Sheikh Zayed, who's the first ruler of the UAE, where when they first struck gold, they didn't know how to drive. So they had camels towing the Cadillac that he was in. So sometimes we don't realize that a lot of our cultures that we're trying to work with or interact with, they're not as what they seem. You know, they're not as deep or as old as maybe you're used to in the UK or even the US or whatever. And to illustrate that, one of my first realizations that, you know, I'm dealing with a different culture here is one of my first days of school, I was teaching a lesson in my English class, and I wanted to give the autonomy to my students and say, hey, we can do two different activities. We can do this activity or this activity. Let's take a vote. You tell me what you guys want to do. Who wants to do this one? Who wants to do activity A? And then people raise their hand. And who wants to do activity B? And a bunch of other students raise their hand and say, okay, it looks like activity A won. You know, most people want to do activity A. Let's do it. Uproar. They were like, what are you doing? What do you mean? I was like, well, what are you talking about? Most people want to do activity A. We're going to do this one today. It's like, well, that's not fair. I was like, why is that not fair? And it's like, because the other student beside me in this classroom is my equal. You're the teacher. You're the authority. I can take orders from you, but I can't take orders from somebody else that's my equal as a student. And I realized, oh, I'm trying to impart trying to involve them in like the democratic way. And that's not how they run their country. That's not how they run their culture. Right. And I just thought that was fair. So the idea of what's fair in our heads, whether we think it's right or wrong or the right way at the end of the day is not the same thing in other cultures sometimes. And that I had to apply those skills and those learnings even when I was building my team in my clothing line. Because, you know, we would have team meetings and we would have to make decisions and things like that. And, you know, some cultures that they just would rather you just give an order rather than you just, you know, trying to see what everybody thinks and try to like sell them the idea. They're like, we don't need to be sold. You already told us. That's it. We're going to do it. You know, so that was a big learning for me because I thought that you had to negotiate everything you want to move forward and try to get everybody on side. And, you know, this is kind of what we're used to in Silicon Valley and what we're used to in the Western world is like let's make sure everybody's included in this decision. Not the case in a lot of other cultures. And you're going to be really actually offending them in some way by trying to force that matter.
It reminds me of a situation when I studied at Holt International Business School, which is a university. They have campuses around the world, including also in Dubai. And I remember vividly, I was on a team with a Japanese team member. And we were talking about, okay, let's do this project. We have about a month to complete it. Let's set up meetings along the way and discuss, you know, the progress of each team member with the assignments that they have. And this one Japanese team member never came with the progress report. He was never saying any, giving us any updates. And I was like really frustrated with this guy because, you know, we had set sort of the guidelines. And me as a Danish person, I was very direct. I was like angry, frustrated, went to the principal and we're like, hey, we need, something is wrong here. Our team member is not completing his assignments. And I'm afraid that it's going to hurt my, my grades. And so I was really aggressive when it came to that. But then later I sort of realized, having worked with Japan over the, you know, last many years, is that Japanese people like to prepare a lot over time. Yeah. And then at the end, come with the information, come with their completed the task and assignment. They don't like to share early because they don't feel comfortable with that. And if I had known that, I would likely have sort of adapted my way of managing that process and collaborating with that team member. So inevitably, you'll experience some culture conflict when you actually start to collaborate with new cultures and are sort of trying to collaborate with team members and so forth when you don't have that experience. So really learning that muscle is really, really important. And so maybe taking it over to the business side of, you know, you bringing Webinar Ninja to new markets, what are some of the things that you did to mitigate the risk of culture conflict? What was the process that you went by to discover new markets, to learn about the culture, to learn about the localization you need to make to then successfully take that business to another market?
As just a personal rule, I don't like to invest in things I don't understand. Like, I need to understand what I'm getting into. I have to have some sort of clue of what this is going to be all about. So as a principal, I like to just go on a holiday to where I may want to go and expand to. I know with Webinar Ninja, when we wanted to get into a new market like Scandinavia, we're like, okay, what are some of the markets we want to hit? We want to hit Denmark. Maybe we want to look at Amsterdam, things like that. It's very hard. Yeah, you can watch some things online. You can ask people. You can do some research. It's very hard to get a good taste of the culture and understand how multicultural or monocultural that culture is. Because, you know, for example, the Dutch, they have a very, you know, multicultural kind of environment where they have influences from other cultures. So they're more adaptable the way they're going to do business, or they're going to understand where you're coming from. But for example, when I went to Copenhagen, you know, it's a one way kind of life, you know, and you have to kind of accustomize yourself to it's not a melting pot. You know, you have to being in that culture. In fact, like becoming a citizen is incredibly hard in Copenhagen and beyond. So it's really hard to get into those cultures and understand, okay, if I do things in a certain way, how is that going to adapt? So for an example, I remember when we first started to look at, okay, how much can we one charge in these markets, but also what are the current kind of go-to solutions for webinar solutions in those areas? You know, what is kind of the household names that they're currently using and why are they using it, right? So one of the things that we did is we tried to do as many customer interviews as possible, potential customer interviews in those areas. And when I was there, I would actually go to meetups, go to actually the startup spaces there, talk to people, ask them, hey, what are you using for, you know, to run your webinars, to run your workshops, things like that. And ask them, like, what do you like about it? What do you hate about it? And understand, because it's very hard to understand the language people use when they describe their products, because I wanted to basically use that language in my marketing and my sales and on my pricing pages and everything when I'm targeting that market, especially with Facebook ads and all that kind of stuff. And it's very hard to do that, you know, without being there, without speaking to the people there. I actually got in touch with a lot of the organizations there so that I can later on run webinars for them, so then I can have their emails, so that I can email them surveys. I'm not trying to sell them anything. I just want to learn more about where they're coming from. And a lot of us, I think we just the knee-jerk reaction is I got to act fast. I got to get into the market as soon as possible. There's not that many competitors right now. I should jump in right now. And I like to take my time. I like to understand what I'm doing first, because what we've done sometimes, like when we went into South America, we understand, like we were trying to evaluate which market in South America we want to go in first. And we realized that like our best chance of success is actually Brazil. And I don't want to go in and try to go super wide, and you know, we don't have unlimited funds. So it's best for you to kind of understand where you're getting into, take your time, be a little bit methodical and understand the market you're in. And then personally, what I like to do, and I could be wrong totally, but what I like to do is just choose one market within that market and try to make an impact, learn from your mistakes in that market, learn what works, what doesn't, and then see if that actually translates to that new market. You know, what we found is that Brazil and Colombia are completely different. You know, like you got to come in with a different game plan, especially when it comes to marketing and understanding that audience.
So there was a ton of great stuff you had said right there that I know we're going to dig into. But to go back to something you said toward the very beginning, we couldn't agree more. You were talking about seeking to understand first. And one thing we found in our research for our book Global Class was that we talked to hundreds of people and nobody ever used the word foreign. It was interesting, you know, and when you use the word foreign, it's sort of like an us versus them, a difference thing. And the way we actually end the book and the conclusion is we say the sentence, you know, if you seek first to learn and understand, nothing will ever be foreign. And, you know, I think that just really tied well with what you were saying and to the experience of those entrepreneurs out there who are successful. It's not about we're just going to shove our model down the throat of every city in this world because we did great in our initial market and it's going to work the same way everywhere else. But having the people who have that mindset that you had are key to being successful in other markets.
And that's exactly one of the reasons why we actually developed a framework to help think about how to localize and expand your business, right? And you alluded to it a little bit earlier about asking questions, you know, pricing and so forth. But I'd love to dig a little bit more into the questions that you were thinking about as you expanded the business to new markets, right? So
yeah,
I'm cheating a little bit here on the call because I'm showing you the business model localization canvas visually, but the audience will not necessarily be able to see it. But if you see here, the business model localization canvas we have developed on top of Alex Osterwalder's business model canvas, the business model innovation canvas, right? And so the way that we're thinking about it, to Aaron's point a little bit earlier, is you take your validated model in your initial market and run it through two filters, right? And you ask yourself key questions that are critical for the business model to succeed and thrive in your market. And so you can see all these different aspects of the business model canvas, but I'd love to learn from you maybe a little bit more. What were some of the top of mind questions that you had to then go and ask, you know, stakeholders in that ecosystem, not necessarily customers only, but, you know, government, it could be even investors, it could be whomever you think are important to speak to answer those questions you had in mind.
One of the first things we wanted to find out had to do with customer service, because our product, Webinar Ninja, is known for great customer service. It's one of the reasons why people stay for so long is because we have a mentality of like, do it for you instead of showing them how to do it. So we like just go into their and help them get through and get out and get started with whatever they're doing with their webinar, their workshop. Having said that, I want to make sure that standard stays high and that becomes one of our cornerstones. So I had to understand, you know, in each market, what were the needs in terms of customer support? You know, first of all, the mediums, like do they need phone support? Or is chat fine? You know, some markets you can get away with just having English and they're okay with it, you know, especially if it's text based. Some markets, no, you're going to need to have somebody on the team that can help you with that local language, or there's, you know, with South America, it's Spanish or Portuguese, and being able to see what does that actually mean in terms of cost or in terms of redundancy in our team, and also just in terms of, you know, there's a difference between language and culture when it comes to support too. Like You know, you can have somebody in Vietnam that is fluent English speaker, but doesn't understand cultural references or idioms, or, you know, that maybe somebody from Canada would know. That was important to us because one of the things that we market is, you know, our support is not robotic. Like, we actually, the real humans talking to you, helping you out, you know, and trying to show a bit of personality. So that was the first thing that came to mind when you asked this question, is like, we were trying to look at like, where do we need to improve or expand or hire for, or even just our support tutorials or our videos, things like that. You know, how can we, you know, make sure it sounds like we built this company in that country, meaning getting voiceover actors to dub our tutorials in the local language, whether it's getting actual, you know, locals to write our support tutorials from scratch and not translate them, all that kind of stuff. So that's the first thing that came to mind.
Oh, that's interesting. And that's often things that aren't as thought of, or you think of the language, but you don't, you know, you don't think of who the source is that you're getting the translation. It's something we heard in our research, a ton of people made mistakes on. And you know, when I recall in particular, we were talking to an executive who came from Turkey, and he said, you know, in Turkey for a long time, it was like there was an embrace of anything like American. Mm-hmm. But then after a while, it was like, no, you know, it needs to be localized for, you know, for Turkish people and how things are different. And that's, you know, something not unique to Turkey. It's really happening all over the world.
And maybe just to add a story to it, just to mitigate the risk of failure, right? I actually learned about a story during my holiday here over Christmas. I didn't know about it, but one of my family relatives talked about Chevy going into Latin America, Chevy, yeah. Nova. And he asked me, why do you think they weren't successful there? And I was like, I couldn't really figure it out. But then he said, basically split no and va, can't go, right? Nova, that's the Spanish, yeah, language. And so bringing Chevy Nova into Latin America doesn't really make sense, right? So, totally. So the positioning, the language, all that matters, plus obviously the operation model and so forth. So doing your due diligence is important, right, is the main message.
Yeah, totally. And just to kind of touch on that, one of the challenges of going international and going global is you don't want to water down or become vanilla. Like, you know, especially with marketing, especially with, you know, email marketing or long form content with your blog, you know, you still want to show your personality. You still want to kind of have inside jokes. You still want to kind of have your own flavor. Often people sacrifice that to be like, oh, you know, well, let's make sure everybody understands every single word in this blog post or something like that. And that's something that we kind of had a struggle with our team, because, you know, our writers really wanted to kind of keep the vibe and, you know, keep it lighthearted, keep it funny, keep it, you know, fun. But at the same time, we wanted to make sure that, you know, we were alienating people that we were kind of inviting to our world as we expand.
So let's talk about that a little bit more, because that's yeah, something that a lot of companies struggle with. You have a company culture. It doesn't always gel well universally. Mm-hmm. Right. An example we like to use is with Walmart. Like, one of Walmart's core values, at least in the past, was respect the individual. Very American concept that doesn't really resonate at all, you know, universally. Yeah. So how do you keep that flavor, but, you know, as something you've said previously, like embracing the cultural differences instead of just attempting to work around them? How do you do that?
Yeah, I think if it's one of the pillars of the business, especially like in terms of the external culture, what you portray to the market, and it's part of what you're all about, it's just a choice you're going to have to make and live with. You know, there are going to be markets that are just not going to resonate with you. Unfortunately, you know, otherwise you're going to just have to change your business, right? And change what you stand for. That Walmart example is perfect. And that's just something that they're going to have to, you know, accept. But that's why I think it's important to think about, where do you want to be in 10 to 15 years? And if you do want to go global, as you start forming these kind of pillars in your business and start, you know, the culture and even just the messaging, the vision that you put out there in the world. But also internally, I think this is something that we had to really work on. because, you know, we employ people across the world, whether it's in the Philippines or Eastern Europe or in South America or in the Middle East or in Africa. Culturally, it's very hard to have everybody on the same page, especially if you're working remotely. One of the things that we try to do as much as possible is meet in person with team retreats and things like that, because one, you want to make sure that they fully understand the vision of the company that you're putting out there in the world, because they may not get it. They may not be like, what are you talking about? Like, that doesn't really resonate with me, like the Walmart example. And you need to kind of break that down, because they're an advocate for your business, especially if they're front facing, whether they're marketing or customer support or sales or success or whatever it is, they need to kind of be on board. And the other part is just that, you know, when you're driving towards one goal as a team and you're trying to make sure that everybody's on the same page and singing from the same song sheet, you know, sometimes we think people get it or we think that everybody's like understanding what you're saying, but just culturally, they don't ask questions, or they don't say no, or they don't, kind of say, I don't, you know, can you repeat that or explain that a little bit? So that is something that I learned the hard way through the years of building businesses, and whether that's with a close team next to me in a different culture, or globally, like right now with my team at Webinar Ninja.
I guess let's dig into that a little bit more. We talk about managing distributed teams, right? Do you have any sort of specific best practices for people who are looking to build international teams? And
yes,
I want to make sure that they can manage them effectively, not just command and control, but maybe also granting autonomy and trust for them to actually go and lead things, because that can also be very difficult with different cultures that may be more accustomed to that command and control type of way of managing people, right? So I guess my bigger question is, one, obviously, how do you manage the team globally, but also how do you change and shift that mindset in certain employees that are used to the hierarchical approach to management, and empower them to actually go and do things a little bit more autonomously themselves?
Yeah, that's a great question, because over the years, what we learned is that at the end of the day, people work in incentives. So whether that's incentivizing them through their KPIs. So for example, one of the principles we have as a remote team is there's no such thing as over-communicating. Like, you have to over-communicate, given the fact that a lot of it's text-based or recorded video or things like that. So one of the KPIs in most of our team members is, are you over-communicating? Like, are you communicating constantly on a daily basis? So we have, for example, daily asynchronous stand-ups where they answer a question every single day, so we understand where everybody's at in their project or what they're doing today or what they got done. But also the understanding that, like, in that first 3 months, this is super critical for us when we hire new people, is to almost bombard them with conversations, with communication, with questions, because we want to get them out of their comfort zone and understand that, like, this is not a passive situation, even if it's asynchronously. So for example, like, we have a weekly quiz for every single new hire where they have a lot of open-ended questions. They have a couple questions they have to record on video, things like that. Just to get them in the habit of, like, in this team, I got to talk a lot. I got to actually communicate my ideas. I got to contribute to the conversation. So in a cultural point of view, like, you know, for example, we have some team members from the Philippines. They don't like to rock the boat. You know, they like to kind of make sure that everybody's happy. And, you know, it's a lot like the Japanese culture, where it's very for the community. And we want to make sure that it's a harmonious kind of situation. And therefore, it's hard for a lot of leaders in that culture to kind of sometimes evaluate people, give constructive criticism or feedback, because they're afraid to offend. So one of the ways we train them to do that is something called just-in-time learning. We schedule it. We don't do it in terms of, like, hey, you did something bad, therefore you have to be in this reprimanding meeting or something like that. So they have a weekly kind of checkup with their team. It's like a one-on-one where basically they answer three questions. It's like, what is one big win for you this week? What is something that you want to get better at? And three, how can me or the rest of the team help you with that? You know, so we put the onus on them to say, okay, I gotta speak up and improve And it's just a regular thing we do. It's not like, oh, it's time for me to get in trouble. It's just a time for us to kind of make sure and check in that everybody's on the same page.
Interesting. So I want to go back to one thing you talked about, because Klaus and I think there's definitely a validation that this is the right way to go, but it kind of goes against a lot of the fast growing company mentality. And that's around what that growth path looks like as you expand in new markets. Often it's like you were talking about before, it's about speed. You know, you got to do this as fast as possible. That wasn't Webinar Ninja's path. And we've heard from executives. One that comes to mind is Catherine Himes, former head of international product localization at Slack, talking about how you don't want to launch and leave. You need to have long-standing commitment to markets as you go into it. And to the point of what I think you were getting at, it's not about attempting to just go into one market after another. It's about choosing the right ones, having that commitment, building that relationship within the local culture and local customer base and maybe employee base. But you mentioned, I think one thing that stuck out was this 10 to 15 year vision you want to think about. So talk about how that's played out with Webinar Ninja's expansion from US to Australia to South America to where you're looking to go next in Europe. How did you make those decisions? What were some of those guiding lights and how did that play out?
Yeah, so one of the first things that we decided is with Webinar Ninja, we want to make sure that we are the number one live teaching tool. So a lot of people use webinars for different reasons. They use it for sales, use it for marketing. They might do it for some sort of like one-off type of workshop. But really our tool, we've built it so that it's conducive to teaching so that you can just focus on what you're teaching and everything can dissolve in the background in terms of the technology. Having said that, this allowed us, because we niched down, it allowed us to kind of go into new markets with that in mind and understand, okay, where in the coaching, in the teaching, in the creator market, are these markets being underserved? And because at the end of the day, I would love to get in a market that really, okay, maybe there's potential to make more money or, you know, there's just more people there. But at the end of the day, if I go in there and I actually don't meet any needs, you know, it's really a waste of a lot of time and money and effort. So I really wanted to go in saying, okay, what's our bread and butter? What do I do really well? What does our product really deliver on? Where in the world does that, do they need that? You know, and what we found is, like, for example, when we were expanding into South America, we found the reason why we started with Brazil is because one, you know, the Brazilian market often gets kind of neglected in South America when it comes to teaching and learning, because it's kind of easier to kind of go in because people just think of language and they think, okay, if I just go with Spanish, I can go with a lot more countries and expand easier. But for us, we started there because one, we hired somebody from there and it allowed us to kind of understand the market a little bit better. And one, we understood that the teaching and learning and the coaching industry there was booming and growing faster than anywhere else in South America. Alongside that, we had some market partnerships. So people that are in that space that we can work with, integration partners as well. So that kind of gave us a leg up in that area. So for us, the vision for us for the long term, 15 years and beyond, is to be the ultimate tool for people to run live courses, to run live training, do their coaching. And in order to do that, we got to find the markets that really need our services, coaches, live learning environments, e-learning environments, things like that. So we start there and then we try to figure out, you know, what would work best in terms of where in that region we want to get started.
I just want to highlight this too, because often what we see, especially for the companies or executives that are in a rush to get this global footprint, is that there's different drivers. One is like, okay, it's the market size. Whereas what I think you're getting at is has to do with culture. I think also to be the number one tool in these markets, what you often see on the other side is these software products that are very easy to make available worldwide. And then they tout, oh, we're, you know, our app or whatever, we're in 150 countries. But you have a very small amount of users in that country. You haven't really localized it. You haven't really committed to the market. You are not number one. You could just have this number to say, oh yeah, we have a bunch of downloads, you know, in different places. Yeah. But I just want to highlight how what you're saying is very different than that as it relates to a web product. And that path is often not taken, sometimes to the detriment of the company.
Yeah, totally. And I mentioned the hire because as a webinar software, it's important for us to be able to run webinars in the local language, in the local culture. Somebody who understands the Brazilian culture and the Brazilian, you know, Portuguese language, but also just because when we run webinars, obviously we're using the tool, so it's kind of like a meta demo. So people are like, okay, as an attendee, I know what it looks like. Questions can be answered in the local language. People can understand like how this is going to work for their own business. You know, even just the demos, the recorded demos that they watch on the actual webinar are all in the local language of that country. It makes a big difference for us because they don't feel like this is an outside entity coming into our market trying to just take our dollars. They actually feel like we made an effort and we're actually trying to see how this works for them.
Awesome. I know we're coming up very close on time, but before we jump into the last part of the podcast, I just want to address a little bit more about the main concept in the book called The Global Class Mindset, right? And what I'm hearing a little bit from you is that the way you're building the company is a little bit along those lines. What we sort of juxtapose the global class mindset is a little bit the legacy mindset, where companies are building with the home market in mind and hard coding the business around that market, meaning you centralize talent. Yeah, and then that feeds into a little bit more of a management mechanism that is a command and control because you're building a scaling in one market, and you're experienced that market and assume that you can just transplant that business model into new markets. But you seem to be building the team more distributed and thereby also building a little bit more flexibility into the organization because you have a little bit more cultural understanding that then enables future growth. And so just want to ask you a simple question here. How do you think that way of building and how you're building the company currently is enabling your growth into new markets?
I'm not sure if the strategy that we're taking is because it's like a calculated strategy and that's the best way to expand globally. Right. I'm just trying to figure out if I was in that market, if I was somebody who's, you know, in Thailand and I was looking for a webinar software, would this resonate with me? Is this something that I actually need and want? And is it talking to me directly in a way that I feel like, okay, it's just not another, you know, global company that's faceless, that has kind of no culture around it. That's kind of how we built our business in the West. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I was the face of the business for a very long time. I was doing a lot of the marketing, sharing my stories, doing my own webinars with the software. So I'm basically just doubling it down what worked for us and just doing it in local markets with local people.
Maybe let me give you an example of a company. Sure. I'm not going to mention the company necessarily, but I have had a meeting with a Korean startup that has raised a couple of hundreds of millions of dollars when it traveled to Seoul. And I asked him a simple question. How many languages could you speak at the office? There are 600 employees and they said 3 languages, right? And so that is a little bit the, I guess, the way that we talk about hard coding the business around one market that sort of prohibits their ability to see opportunities around the world, but also to tap into employees' insights, you know, into other markets, right? And thereby being able to maybe accelerate a little bit faster because they're able to see those opportunities, but also quickly ask key questions related to, I guess, the business model canvas to customers locally or to stakeholders locally, because they may have connections there as well. So setting your company up along those lines, hiring a little bit more internationally, or at least with people who have international experiences, in our opinion, will enable your company to build a much more, I guess, globally ready company and also product overall, right? So
1,000%. One of the practices that we do is because we try to have a global company and we hire from around the world and so that we can be able to have an understanding. But our head of product, before we push any changes to the UX or the UI of the software to production, they do a quick video and get feedback from the whole team. Does this make sense? You know, one of the things that we changed early on is have the ability to change the word webinar on the button that says register for this webinar, you know, on our software, and right. allow them to kind of change that, because in some markets, the word webinar is not something that is popular or understood. They want to change it to workshop or class, you know? Right. So, and that came from feedback from our team where they were like, I'm not really sure if somebody like my mom understands what webinar means.
Right. No, Aaron and I, we have the same conversation, right? I'm Danish, I'm European, I'm not perfect with English. And Aaron is obviously born and raised in America, and we have different lenses, right, to look at things.
Yeah.
And that, you know, improves our overall ability to communicate to a global audience, right? Because we're constantly refining things. So totally agree on that. I guess we want to move into the last segment of the podcast before we wrap up, and we're moving into the three pieces of advice. So imagining, you know, if you imagine you are coming down the elevator, you have to answer the three questions very quickly, not elaborately. Are you ready for that?
Sure.
Oh, cool. All right. So the first one is, what one piece of advice would you have for someone interested in building a career around international business or in international business?
My one piece of advice is just ask yourself, do you really want to do this? Because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of research. It's a lot. It's a commitment. You're getting into a new market. That means that you're going to at least put in a couple of years to just get your footing and be able to make an impact. So ask yourself, do you want to stay local or do you want to go international? And understand that this is a commitment.
Awesome. What one piece of advice would you have for a business leader expanding a business to new markets?
Travel as much as possible. Travel not only the places you want to expand, but places that maybe you've never even thought about going to. You might be inspired to take a look at maybe doing business there.
Maybe not travel to fancy hotels, but actually to pockets where you actually experience the culture as well, right? So that's
important. Yeah, speak to locals, yeah.
What one piece of advice would you have for your younger self? You're young already, I know. So don't worry about it. You're not that old. So what advice do you have for yourself?
The funny thing is I know that I wouldn't take the advice. I'd be too stubborn. But my quick answer would be to have a long-term view. And this is something that the meaning of long-term when you're younger means like 5 years. But I'm talking, you know, have a 30-year view. What do you want to do in 30 years? What do you want to be known for? What do you want to have built? And that really would be the advice I'd give.
But also allow for pivots along the way, right?
Yeah, of course. You can't fight change. You can't fight the market sometimes. And also there's things that are out of your control. You don't have full control over everything that's around you.
There you go.
Well, Omar, there's a ton of great advice you shared from, you know, seeking to understand when you're looking at new markets and getting the why behind why customers do things. That there's a difference between language and culture and having the importance of that native knowledge. But at the same time, not being vanilla, still having your own flavor, you know, how it's really important that everyone culturally needs to be on the same page and how you need to verify to cut through some cultural differences to ensure that, that there's no such thing as over-communicating, especially with the distributed team. And probably most importantly, if you want people across the world to attend your webinars, you can't always call it a webinar. You might have to call it something else to get people to come, right? So. Yeah. Thank you, Omar. We really appreciate what you're doing to educate others through your podcast, as well as how you're enabling a lot of people to teach others throughout the world through Webinar Ninja.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Klaus. Appreciate it.
Thank you.